we get the program underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the show our friend, the broadcaster, author, along with Ron Borges, of the wonderful book Present at the Creation, and a longtime NFL scout and executive, Upton Bell, joins us this afternoon. Upton, good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, and I might add to that, if people would go online and check the Upton Bell collection at UMass Amherst, they will see the whole history, Rich, of football from the 1875s to today through the eyes of my grandfather and father and mother. It's quite a collection.
It is a remarkable collection indeed, and we want to talk more about that. But on this day, we also want to talk about Martin Luther King Jr. and a number of related topics, beginning with the fact that you were in Memphis on that May day in 1968 when Dr. King was assassinated.
Yeah, well, it's one of the more unforgettable days in my life. I happened to be at spring practice at Memphis State, and they had three or four pro prospects. I was there. And at the end of practice, you go in early in the morning, you look at film, and then you talk to the coaches. And later that afternoon, for the first time in my life, a coach told me I should not come back the next day. And and I said, well, why? I said, did I do something? He said, no. He said, Martin Luther King is arriving today and tomorrow leading the garbage man strike against the city of Memphis. And he said, I think there's going to be violence here. Now, no coach ever in my career had ever told me that or ever told me to go home. So I took the clue. I went back to the hotel, canceled my reservation the next day, got a flight out late that afternoon. And when I arrived at Friendship Airport in Baltimore, I'm walking out of the place and I'm looking up at one of the monitors and it says Martin Luther King has been assassinated. And it's left a mark on me ever since that day about not only the struggle it went on during the 60s that I was in the middle of, but how profound that moment was that day in my life and how I just happened to be there. As I was, Rich, too, not quite in Selma, but out on the outskirts of Selma, Alabama, the day that many African Americans were gassed and beaten, and it was really for people who listen to your show, the people you talk to, that are going through the whole thing today with what's going on with Trump in the last 4 years and the disaster of it. The '60s were maybe more violent than what you've seen today, but the difference is nobody was trying to overthrow the government. In those days, they were doing more of trying to keep African Americans down. And of course, it was just a terrible, terrible year.
The subject of race relations, the civil rights struggle, is the centerpiece of a wonderful new movie directed by Regina King. We'll talk about with Alan Adams later. The movie is One Night in Miami. And Upton, you saw it over the weekend. I did as well. And knew very well a couple of the major participants that are a part of that film, Jim Brown and, of course, Muhammad Ali.
I did, and the interesting thing about it was that I saw that site. I wasn't in Miami. I was in Houston that night, but had gotten into a theater to see the fight. And ironically, I knew both Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown, who I'd met, who had won my father's Burt Bell Award a few years earlier. And the interesting thing, just quickly, because you're going to do the movie review about the movie, is it really captures those people. And you look at the four that were there, and including, by the way, a lot of people don't know that in that time period when Muhammad Ali was seemed to be going crazy and actually was getting ready to fight Liston and all of the publicity around it, a young Malcolm X was with him all during that 10-day period and actually was recruiting him for what later on became the Black Muslims and Elijah Muhammad. But the movie captures, and you think that you're going to be bored by four men in a room together over that period of time, but it's incredible. But the thing about Ali is years later on, we developed a relationship. And I used to call him when he was at his training camp in Pennsylvania like once or twice a week. And it was hilarious. I mean, we really didn't talk boxing. He talked about life. He talked about what it was like out there, that he wanted to recapture what life was like without any of the indoor facilities. You would have no toilet, no electricity in his cabin, no heat, no nothing. And if he wanted to watch television, he had to walk down to another place to watch what was going on in TV. He was one of the most rich, and I'd like to say to your audience, one of the most intelligent, quick-thinking man of the world that I've ever dealt with in my life. He was bigger than boxing, and for somebody who only went to high school, he would have gotten a PhD at any major university. He was that bright, that quick, and with the world. As far as Jimmy Brown was concerned, they called him Jimmy Brown then. He's now called Jim Brown. He was at the forefront, and there's a famous picture of him with Muhammad Ali and then the Lew Center, who eventually became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and many of the leading African-Americans of their time. And Brown was much more quiet, but I always thought Jim Brown had a very hard edge to him through his experiences at Syracuse and before that in dealing with a white man's world. He looked at it, Ali sparred with the white man's world. Ali took it on in a different kind of funny, sting like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Ali was constantly putting the white man on. Jim Brown was completely different. And when he left the Cleveland Browns, everybody said, there's no way a black man is going to make it in Hollywood. But he was in all those black exploitation films and actually had a pretty damn good career. But thinking about those people and that time and what you're going to do with your review on the movie today, I think everybody should see it for not only the great experience of the moment in this film of bringing some of the most iconic people, including Sam Cooke, who I grew up with, who was the leading crooner of his day, and all of them together for this 1 week. They all were there, but never in this room together. It's really an amazing piece. And the woman, it might be the first African-American woman to ever be nominated as the best director. And in Regina King, people might not remember this, but she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress in Beale Street. So there's great history here. I'm really excited about it, and I hope your audience would be.
Absolutely. We're talking with Upton Bell on Downtown. Well, One Night in Miami talks about that meeting of the minds, but another one took place. And could you tell us more of what went on when Bill Russell got together with Don Shula, Johnny Unitas, and Sonny Jurgensen?
It was like a Sermon on the Mount. And the way it happened was Bill Russell, like Muhammad Ali, were going around to the different college campuses and lecturing. And in the case of Ali, he needed the money, and they were paying big money for him to go and lecture the students around America on what civil rights meant and his whole life. Russell, on the other hand, was, like Jim Brown, more hard-edged, more right to the point, and was a big a kind of hero and also a big attraction on the campus like Ali. I get a call one day. John Unitas had just opened up his place, his restaurant called the Golden Arm, and it was right outside of Baltimore, and Unitas had gotten in contact, or his people, with Bill Russell, who was coming. I think he was at Maryland, and then he was coming into Boston to lecture, and said, would you come to lunch? So Unitas invited Don Shula. Shula invited me. And Shula then called Sonny Jurgensen, who was with the Redskins at the time, and said, come over, we're going to have lunch with Bill Russell. And what a moment. You think about four Hall of Fame players and Lou Upton Bell listening to this conversation from Russell about what it was like. And Russell had a tremendous sense of humor, by the way, talking about what it was like then, what it was like in the NBA. He didn't get into deeply some of the real problems that he had here in Boston, but he just talked overall about the whole campaign and what it was like at that time. Then Jurgensen and Unitas got involved, and then Shula got involved. And if you were to be able to record your show that day and listen to what I heard. It changed, again, my perspective on the whole African-American, then called the Black Movement. And basically, you could see among athletes, which if it was a conversation with Russell with three other people or four other people, it would have been more straightforward. But it was the jockeying kind of for position, and also the kind of the conversation went back and forth very, very easily among one African-American and four other white men. And the camaraderie in the conversation that you very rarely would ever get. It was quite a moment. And through many of those experiences I had in the 60s, it's really formed my ideas, my feelings about sports, about politics, about music, about really everything. And it reminds me today, something that I tweeted out earlier, that how could the NFL be called America's game when basically many really good African-American assistant coaches are not getting the opportunity to coach in the NFL? I think Eric Bieniemy of Kansas City is the only one that might end up with a job, and that might be in Houston, which might be the worst place. Pretty hard to realize that 70%, Rich, and growing, of the NFL is African-American, and there are no head coaches.
Well, let's talk a little football left in. Tom Brady headed to his 14th conference championship game, and he certainly wasn't the key to the victory yesterday. That was the work of the defense against New Orleans. But what's your perspective on the performance that we've seen from Tom Brady at age 43?
Well, I think the one thing, and being the son, a lot of people look at Bert Bell, my father, as the commissioner of the NFL and founder of the Eagles, but he was really a quarterback who threw the first pass in Rose Bowl history. So I come from the perspective of being a son of a quarterback. One of the things, even when a quarterback like Brady, one of the all-time greats, loses some of that physical ability at the age of 43, it's the institutional knowledge that you gain over a period of time that will cover up for some of the things that you no longer can do. And I think the amazing thing about Brady in this case is that he really went to Tampa and changed the color of the culture of that whole organization. I mean, they have been the biggest losers in sport. I have a question about their coach, Bruce Arians. He's my cup of tea. But basically, he went there, and more so than even though throwing 40-plus touchdowns in a year, that he changed the culture. It was almost like players wanted to be there. They wanted to be part of it. And they during the season, I think they got better and better as they added different pieces. And again, I think his major contribution there, although I think he had a decent game yesterday, is that basically he changed the culture. He got them to believe in themselves. He did make some key plays when they needed it, especially against a terrific New Orleans defense. On the other hand, Drew Brees, who's been one of the greats, just really had a bad day. And so Brady moves on. But what does it mean for New England? As Tom Curran, and I'm sure Chad Finn will discuss this with you later on, it the cupboard is bare here. And I think it was a terrible mistake. I thought it was a terrible mistake before, but not for the reasons of loving Brady or what he did here or anything else like that. It was, my feeling was, sign him to a two-year contract, pay him what he always deserved, even though it was the end of his career, his life as a quarterback, and give yourself, buy the time to get two more years out of him, which would be pretty good, buy that time to find another quarterback and also rebuild your team. So the cupboard is bare, could be years before they ever find a quarterback again. And again, their defense was really not very good this year. Their offense is really, the cupboard is bare there too. So you're looking at a franchise that let their quarterback go. They could have at least made the playoffs. But the biggest thing to me, as a former general manager, is they didn't buy the time to find themselves somebody else. And now I think they're in deep trouble.
It's interesting because obviously they lost a lot more than Tom Brady after last season. But I had a friend bring up the example of the Cleveland Browns. Paul Brown, when he had Otto Graham at quarterback, went to 10 straight championship games. Brown retired, Graham retired, and Paul Brown never got back to that championship game. Now we see the Patriots struggling and Brady in another conference championship game. So who's more important to a successful franchise, that superstar quarterback or a brilliant coach?
It's a combination, but if I had my choice, it would be the quarterback. You cannot win. The most important position, Rich, in pro sports, well, in college sports too, is the quarterback. There's just no way of finding somebody like a Brady. Again, it's very, very hard to find, and that is true about Paul Brown, and I saw many of his games. I consider Brown the greatest coach of all time, not Belichick, although Belichick would be in the top three or four as far as I'm concerned. But you're at the mercy, particularly in that game of football, if you don't have the quarterback. So it is absolutely true. Look at every great coach. Weeb Eubank with John Unitas. Shula with Unitas. Shula with Marino. Shula with Bob Greasy. You go right down the line. John Elway in Denver. Any of them. Patrick Mahomes. What would Kansas City be without him? We're going to find that out this Sunday if he can't play. And I believe it's a good chance he might not be able to play. You cannot win without a quarterback. So when you look at it here, Belichick, a great coach, but it's really Brady that was the most important a part of this team. And I think that's the way you have to look at it. It's not a knock at Belichick, but you're going to find people will come out and say, name Belichick how many playoff games he's made without Brady. And name any playoff game he won. He won one with Cleveland. I mean, that's not an indictment. That's not these crazy talk show stuff that want to, you know, really put it, well, they really want to put it in Boston to Belichick. I don't want to do that. What I'm saying is, and I've always said, no quarterback, you're going nowhere.
Upton, you mentioned the wonderful collection that you've donated to the University of Massachusetts, and it is a remarkable treasure trove of your family's history, not just your dad, Bert Bell, but your mother, Frances Upton. Can you talk about some of the things that are in that collection that people have the opportunity to see?
Well, hopefully someday when it reopens, I'll be able to go out and see it. And it's on the 25th floor there, and it's really amazing what they have in their collection there. They have the Mark McCormick collection, all of his papers when he was the famous agent for Nicholas and Palmer and Player and many other people, Joe Montana. But they also have the Pentagon Papers there now. And in this huge case with another 144 items that can't fit in the case is my father's gold football from Penn. There's items going all the way back to 1895. My grandfather, John C. Bell Sr., was the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, but also the founder of the modern NCAA, and actually negotiated with Teddy Roosevelt for a new type of league that would not involve all the deaths that they've had before. So all of those things are there. Bert Bell's, a lot of his memorabilia is in there. There are footballs at George, gold footballs, solid gold footballs that George Halas in 1946 gave to me and to my father after they won the championship. You can name it, and there are items. I even have a playbook for my team in Charlotte, North Carolina, of the opening game against Donka Kick and Moorfield. So it goes all the way back, but then it comes forward to today. And on the website, you can see a lot of those different items. But eventually, like interviews with you on your show will be on there. People can click on and hear our interview today. They can hear other interviews from. And the other thing is, not only those interviews, but I'm being contacted all over the country by historians that have seen this online and said, you know, we want to do something on it. And there's even now a good chance that there'll be a documentary on my life with these different people. So It's some look. And finally, Sidney Blumenthal, who you should have on your show someday, who is on his fifth volume on the life of Lincoln. He actually worked in the White House for Hillary and Bill Clinton. He went back when I put one of his volumes in my other collection. He went back. He said, "Do you know that your great-grandfather was a close friend of Abraham Lincoln?" And I said, "No, I did not know that." He said, "Well, I'm sending you the letters between your great-grandfather and Lincoln." Wow. They are in that collection.
Well, that's incredible. Wow. Well, Upton, it is always a delight for us to get to talk with you. We thank you, as always, for making time for us this afternoon. And enjoy the final day and a half or so of the Trump presidency. And we'll talk with you again soon.
Did he have one?
Well, he occupied his space. Let's say that.
Oh, my God. Well, anyway, good luck, and thank you, and love Maine. Talk to you again.
Thank you very much. Upton Bell with us on Downtown. You can check out the Upton Bell collection at the University of Massachusetts online. And if you haven't, read Upton's terrific book with Ron Borges, Present at the Creation.